Welcome to the podcast of this Brecan information session. Information sessions are recorded at the Brecan Resource Centre and can be borrowed in CD format from the Resource Library. Sessions are copyrighted and are for personal home use only. If you would like to know more about this and other sessions, please contact Brecan on 1300 781 500. We hope you enjoy this podcast. This session was recorded on the 15th of November 2010 at Brecan's Resource Centre, located in Melbourne's CBD. Rosalind Drummond is a radiation oncologist from Peter Mac, who has specialised in the treatment of women with cancer for over 20 years. In this talk about the use of high-energy X-rays as an agent to kill cancer cells, Rosalind gives an overview of the history of radiotherapy, discusses the use and benefits of radiotherapy and the current trends for its application in the treatment of cancer. We hope you enjoy this session, Radiotherapy, Myths and Reality.
Radiotherapy is really the use of ionising radiation in the treatment of disease. And in the modern day setting, it pretty much is exclusively cancer. And I'm just going to start off with a little bit of history, because X-rays were first discovered by this man, this is William Rankin, in 1895. And a year later, radioactivity was discovered by a guy called Henry Becquerel. But this lady, Marie Curie, is given credited with most people would think she's the discoverer of radioactivity, although it's her supervisor, Henry Becquerel, who discovered it. She gets credit for most of the work on radium and radioactive isotopes. And I guess from these two discoveries, two of the sort of big tools of modern medicine have arisen, and that's diagnostic radiology and all these radiological tests, and radiation oncology or radiotherapy, which is the treatment side of things. Within about a year of the discovery of X-rays, they were first used by this man, Emil Gruber, in Chicago, to treat breast cancer. Now, whilst historically radiation therapy was X-rays or radium isotope sources for treatment, these days we have a big variety of types of radiation available to us, although X-rays, gamma rays and electrons really are the mainstay of all cancer treatments. X-rays are part of the electromagnetic spectrum, which is illustrated here. It includes radio waves and visible light. Photons of energy, which have greater than 10 electron volts of energy, are considered to be ionising, so that's up the left-hand end of that scale. And ionising radiation is caused that because when the radiation interacts with atoms and material, it ejects one of the orbital electrons from the atoms and thereby creates an ion. Now, these ions are very chemically reactive, and when you have this process occurring in biological material, it's the ionisation of the atoms of the cells and the water molecules, which make up most of the cell, that result in highly chemically reactive ions, which go on basically to damage DNA. And this damaged DNA means that when the cell tries to multiply and grow and divide, it can't, and it dies at that point. I guess you can see this is a chromosome preparation from an irradiated cell, and you can see really what the characteristic changes induced in chromosomes by radiation, literally fairly high dose of radiation. This is what a normal looking chromosome looks like. This one's got 2 centimetres, and these ring forms, and these little left over little bits that have been broken off, characteristically seen after irradiation of cells. Now, cell populations which are dividing more rapidly show their radiation damage more promptly and to a greater degree. Anyway, cancer cells sustain more damage and die more from exposure to radiation because they're generally dividing more quickly than the normal cell populations. They may well be just intrinsically more sensitive to radiation damage. But the other major reason is that cancer cells can't repair and recover from radiation as well as normal cells do. And so what's essentially a small difference is increased by dividing or giving the radiation in multiple fractions, so that with each one adds up the damaging effects on the cancer cells but minimises the damaging effect on the normal cells, so you get a bigger differential effect. And so it effectively maximises the cancer cell killing of the radiation and minimises any damaging effects to normal cells. Basically all the cells in the path of a radiation beam are affected by the radiation, so that the normal tissues, when you are giving radiotherapy, are also affected by that radiation. And I guess it's well established really what are the radiation doses that you can give to particular tissues that before you start to cause significant irreparable damage. And I guess what you can see from this is a table of what are called the tolerance doses, which are really considered to be the sort of upper limit of what are safe doses to give in radiation treatment to particular tissues, are listed here, and you can see that they're different really for different tissues. And so it's basically the nature or the normal tissues in the path of the radiation beam when you're treating a tumour that limit the maximum amount of radiation you can give to that particular area. So radiotherapy treatment is essentially divided into two different types, really related to how far the radiation source is from what you're treating. And so teletherapy, the radiation source is some distance away from the target volume, and this is really the major part of our cancer treatment, sometimes also called external beam radiotherapy. Teletherapy is the people in the industry. But with teletherapy, it's using linear accelerators as the radiation source, primarily in this country. Tele-cobalt therapy machines may also produce external beam treatment. And the dose delivered really depends on the energy of the beam and also the distance from the target. That's particularly important. Brachytherapy, on the other hand, is using radioactive isotopes either in the form of seeds or wires, and it's putting them into the actual tissue, so either implanted into the tissue or into normal body cavities. And this is really an implant in a breast where the radioactive wire is actually in these little pole thing tubes within the breast itself. And this is just an X-ray of that sort of implant, so that the wires you can see running across are the radioactive wires in the breast. And the major advantage of brachytherapy is the rapid fall off of dose that occurs away from the actual sources, because here 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 refer to the sources themselves as if they're going into the plane of the screen. And you can see the dose falls off really according to the inverse square law, so that it means if you double the distance, the dose drops to a quarter. So you get rapid fall off of dose. And so brachytherapy is a good way of treating a localised area by putting a source of actually right at the tumour and giving little radiation beyond the area. This is a picture of an X-ray of the pelvis, but these are radioactive sources actually in the uterine cavity and in the vagina, and again you can see a rapid fall off in dose away from the actual uterus, which is where those sources are. Okay, but brachytherapy can treat a limited area. It's usually used as part of curative treatment, but it requires quite a bit of skill from the operator putting the radioactive sources in the right place. So since the discovery of radiation, there's been really a steady improvement in the technology of the machinery producing radiation, and also the ability to direct and shape radiation beams. And the modern era in radiotherapy began in 1937, when the first mega voltage X-ray imaging machine was produced. And megavoltage energy is millions of electron volts, is the energy of the radiation beam, and that's considerably more powerful radiation than the sort of radiation you take X-ray pictures with. Megavoltage radiation, I guess, has got some particular advantages for treatment over lower energy radiations, and I guess that's what's listed here. And I'll show you some examples, really. That's what these next slides are about. Because this demonstrates, I guess, these are really megavoltage range beams, and these are lower energy beams. This is the sort of energy they take X-ray pictures with. And this is really looking at the relative dose compared with the depth or in the tissue or in the material. And you can see from this that the megavoltage beams or supervoltage beams give you a lot more dose a lot further into the tissue compared with these low energy beams where the dose falls off very quickly. The other difference is that with these low energy beams, 100% of the dose occurs on the skin and it progressively falls, whereas with megavoltage beams, you have what's called skin sparing, where the maximum dose falls some distance below the surface. And this distance depends on the energy of the beam. But it means that the skin is not a dose, not the tissue that limits the dose you can give now. And this was really this is what we talk about with the penumbra. And high energy or megavoltage energy X-ray beams have a very sharp edge to them. They don't scatter about and spray about, so that you have a very sharp cut off at the edge of the beam, which means you can restrict where you irradiating a lot more definitely and not a lot more clearly. And I guess the greater penetration means, of course, there's a beam from the front and the back here, you can get a much more even distribution of dose through really a very thick part of the body, because that's meant to be held. And so, and this is a modern linear accelerator, this is top of the range, if you like, Rolls-Royce linear accelerator. They produce megavoltage beams, energy beams, which can be shaped into complex shapes by multi-leaf collimators, which are actually up here in the tube head. They can be very precisely and accurately directed to tumours in the patient. And the other advantage is these megavoltage machines also produce high-energy electron beams, which you can use for treatment as well. Radiotherapy, I guess, is like surgery in that it's really a local treatment. So by that, we're really comparing it with the systemic treatments. Local treatment really means it treats the region or the area where the tumour is, as compared to drug treatments, which will go via the bloodstream and potentially go to all parts of the body. And just to summarise, I guess, the biological effects of radiation that you see are related to the total dose, the number of fractions into which it's divided, or the size of each fraction, the total time over which it's given, and the region of the body that is being treated, because that gives you the different tissues that are being treated. Now, radiation is really a very effective cancer cell killing agent, much more effective than chemotherapy, I might add. But the side effects, well, to where you're giving it, kills off cells more efficiently, more predictably, and more certainly than chemotherapy. But as I said before, it's a local treatment, so you're only treating a particular region with radiotherapy, you're not treating the whole body. But the side effects of radiation are really related to the biological effects on the normal tissues. And radiation side effects are divided into acute effects, which are those that occur during or just after the treatment is given, and late effects, which occur more than 12 months after the treatment has been given. So acute effects are really seen most in the rapidly dividing cell systems. The doses used in normal clinical practice, they always fully recover. Late effects, I guess, by definition, occur more than 12 months after the treatment has been delivered, and they develop progressively over time. and they're usually irreparable. And so they're the dose-limiting effects in radiation therapy. And that's really the light effects relate to those tolerance doses I told you about. The tolerance doses are doses that give you minimal light effects in a particular tissue. Now, radiotherapy treatment is used in a number of different ways, or has a number of different roles. And I guess the first, we'll go through a couple of these in somewhat more detail. Radiocurable tumours are really tumours that are, I call that because they're tumours that are cured by radiation alone as the only treatment. And I guess classically Hodgkin's disease fell into this category. These days it's not usually treated with radiation, but it's treated as a radiocurable tumour. Seminoma of the testis is another good example where radiotherapy is really the best and the definitive treatment. Radiotherapy combined with surgery to improve local control is really one of the classical roles of radiotherapy in post-mastectomy radiotherapy, and also irradiation after people have had a rectal cancer removed from the head and neck cancers. And the third category, I guess, is relatively younger than the others, because it's really a situation where radiotherapy or surgery would be equally curative, but you prefer to use the radiotherapy because you can preserve organ function. And that particularly relates to cancer of the vocal cord, is probably the best example of that. Don't want to take the voice box out, person can't talk forever. But you can cure them with radiotherapy 99% of the time, and preserve vocal function so people can talk. And breast conservation treatment is in that category as well. Radiotherapy combined with chemotherapy is really things like Hodgkin's disease, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, some of the gastrointestinal cancers where you're aiming to cure them, but surgery is really not an option. And obviously you can combine radiotherapy with both chemotherapy and surgery in terms of to improve overall survival and local control. And then radiotherapy certainly gets used in patients who are not fit to have an operation, who would otherwise have an operation for their cancer. And it's also used in palliative treatment. This was number two on that list, and I guess it's using radiotherapy after what's intended to be curative surgery to improve or decrease the risk of local recurrence and possibly improves overall cure. Because really, if you look at the history of breast cancer, the first cures of breast cancer were really occurred in the late 1800s, when a man called William Helsted, first started doing the Helsted radical mastectomy. This isn't actually Helsted radical mastectomy, and Helsted thought it certainly cured a percentage of patients, something like about 50% of patients, with the operation alone. But it soon became apparent that some patients got recurrent tumour in the mastectomy area or in the regional lymph nodes or also in other parts of the body. And so in the And, as I showed you that picture of Emil Gruber, first used radiation to treat breast cancers in 1896, and it was a recurrent breast cancer, was the patient he treated. But that was the beginnings. In the 1940s, I guess, a Scottish radiation oncologist named Robert McWhirter really first demonstrated without doubt that radiotherapy to the mastectomy area and the regional nodes after a mastectomy substantially reduces the risk of local recurrence. And so this has really been, it's the traditional, the classical role of radiotherapy in breast cancer treatment. This slide tends to show you that this is the incidence of local recurrence related to the size of the primary tumour and the number of lymph nodes involved with the cancer. Now, when they were treating bigger cancers with more lymph nodes involved, the rates of local recurrence were relatively high. But today, most of the cancers that are diagnosed are less than 2 centimetres in size, and the majority of them don't have any lymph nodes involved. So when people have small tumours with few lymph nodes involved, there's not much benefit from post-mastectomy radiotherapy because their risk of local recurrence after the surgery is low. This is a modern trial of radiotherapy, but it demonstrates that there is the risk of local recurrence is low, 10% or less, in small tumours without nodes involved, whereas it's moderately high in bigger and more lymph node involved tumours. And radiotherapy certainly drops that risk of local recurrence down to a very low level, does that in both groups, but the real gain is more in the high risk patients. The other bit of evidence, which certainly is evident in modern trials, is that you actually see a small but a definite improvement in the cure rate or the overall survival for people when you prevent local recurrence. And so really the indications for whether you have post-mastectomy radiotherapy or not really relate to the factors that indicate a higher risk of local recurrence, and that's what I've summarised here. And it's certainly more than 3 lymph nodes from the axillary lymph nodes involved with the cancer, bigger cancers, and cancers that are invading or infiltrating the skin or the muscle. Don't often see that these days. And you may consider if people have one of the above factors, plus they have some of these factors at the bottom here, which are basically things you find on the pathology. So we'll move on and talk about radiotherapy after limited surgery, really to give you the same cure rate of the cancer but to preserve organ function. And it's stretching a bit to say that about breast conservation, but it preserves the breast, not the breast function. And so since the 1970s, it's been apparent that curative treatment for early breast cancers is achieved either by local excision and radiotherapy and conserving the breast, or by total mastectomy. And so really these are the survival curves from some of the randomised trials, which show that really there's no difference in overall survival whether people have a mastectomy or whether they have a local excision and radiotherapy. And so there really is a choice for women with early stage breast cancer these days. They can have a mastectomy and have a high chance of being cured, or they can have local excision and radiotherapy. The difference being, if you have a mastectomy, they lose the breast. Whereas if you have local excision, you need to have radiotherapy to have the same cure rate for the cancer, but you preserve the breast. And most women actually opt to have breast preservation or local excision and radiotherapy. This is a lady who's been treated. So left breast has been treated. And so the randomised trials actually all show that the radiotherapy is important because it's important for reducing the risk of local recurrence in the breast. And I guess these are the major randomised trials, whereas the first column shows the risk of recurrence is somewhere around 35%, whereas post-radiotherapy it's under 10%. So that, next one. There is also, I guess more recently, some evidence that there is actually a small but definite survival advantage, this is in the breast conservation setting, not post-mastectomy, from preventing local recurrence in the breast as well. So, in breast conservation treatment, the surgery is removing the obvious cancer lump, but it is not actually the curative treatment. And the aim is to remove the cancer lump. This is a painting by Caravaggio. It's actually St. Peter healing the wounds of St. Agatha. Agatha, patron saint of breast disease and breast cancer. Yeah. Slightly less gory than the surgery. Anyway, the surgery, I guess, is followed by radiation treatment given to the whole breast. Using linear accelerator, and I guess it's usually 5 weeks radiotherapy, although in younger women it may be 6 weeks treatment. Mm. Next one. And in this, we actually exploit all those benefits I told you about in megavoltage radiotherapy, because this is the dose distribution across the breast in one-day treatment, and you can see that the dose on the skin is less than the tumour dose, which is the green and the blue lines through the breast here. So the skin is relatively spared. We've got a very sharp edge to the path of radiotherapy being here, which is protecting all the other tissues that we don't want to treat. And the penetration really gives us pretty even distribution across the whole breast volume. And so, next one. So the side effects of the breast radiotherapy in this setting are actually very few, but the treatment is very well tolerated. Most people would continue to go to work or do their normal daily activities as they go through the treatment. But a significant proportion of people certainly get tired. In fact, most people get some fatigue to some degree, but it's returned to normal by about 6 weeks post-treatment. And everyone gets some skin erythema. It's rare to get any broken or blistered skin, and that's a direct result of the skin sparing I showed you. The next picture. This is a lady right at the end of treatment, and that shows you about how red people get. And by 2 weeks, that's gone. And it's back to normal. Next one. And I just thought, for those who are interested, I mean, the care during radiotherapy is pretty common sense. It's really rest when you're tired, look after the skin, avoid extra irritation. There's a lot of mythology about skin care and radiotherapy. Everyone's got their own secret remedy. I should say it's all rubbish. It's just common sense. Not doing things to avoid things that irritate the skin. Use a moisturiser or a soothing type cream on the skin. Really what you want is something that's not going to add to the irritation of the skin, and it will all the acute effects, which is what the redness is, will all get better shortly after the treatment finishes. This is really looking at the late effects. All the late effects from breast-conserving radiotherapy are rare, and they're usually asymptomatic. But you can see they're all 1% or less. So forget the one about armadina, because that relates to axilla treatment, not the breast, and I can't delete it from there. One of the rare side effects, which really continues to raise a lot of concerns for people, is in relation to the heart. And in the 1980s, the early breast cancer collaborative trials group, which is really pools all the clinical trials for breast cancer and looks at some of the outcome results, really published some data that suggested that showed that there was a small but definite increase in the risk of death from cardiac events in the second or third decade after radiotherapy. So that means more than 10 years post-treatment. Didn't see it before that. And this small mortality, if you like, was exactly equal to the, if you like, the benefit, the survival benefit from having radiotherapy. So all the early radiotherapy trials really showed no survival benefit from radiotherapy, at least that's the modern day explanation. But in those, and I guess this is, illustrates really the sort of things you had to plan on in the past, which were just external contours or tracings of the shape of a person. We used relatively generous and wide radiotherapy beams, and you really didn't know where the heart was in relation to treatment. And if you compare that with sort of what we plan on modern day treatment, this is a CT picture through of a person through the chest, showing us where the breast is, shows us where the heart and the lungs are, and it enables you to modify the treatment if you have got a lot of parts in the field. So the technological advantages have certainly made a big improvement in relation to cardiac toxicity, and I guess the more recent evaluations from the early breast cancer trials group has shown that this cardiac mortality issue relates to old radiotherapy trials, and it's not seen in any of the modern day radiotherapy trials, and that is where they can actually measure this very small, about 2% improvement in overall survival for people who do have radiotherapy. It's actually not the radiotherapists that are preventing local recurrence that improves the survival. But I thought I would go on and talk about some of the, if you like, the issues and the ongoing areas of research, because most of them, radiotherapy in breast cancer anyway, are in relation to breast conservation treatment. And I guess I've listed really the major research topics, although I'm only going to talk about the first couple of them. So we'll start with the first one, which are ways of reducing toxicity and potentially increasing convenience. And the next one. And I've listed some of the areas that you can think of to do this. And I guess the first one is really the most obvious one, which is really just not giving radiotherapy to particular groups of patients if their risk of local recurrence is very low. Next one, please. And I guess for a long time, ever since breast conservation has been a treatment, so since about the 1970s, people have been trying to prove which patients don't need to have radiotherapy. And to date, we cannot pick out a group of patients who do not benefit from radiotherapy after breast-conserving surgery in terms of reducing their risk of local recurrence. And this is using all the pathological factors that we've got, which are supposed to indicate lower risks of local recurrence. And so there are still ongoing trials in this area, but it's just not possible to pick a group of people who routinely get very little benefit from the radiotherapy in the breast-conserving setting. Next one. And so we look at some of the technical advances that have helped. And I guess the use of more sophisticated imaging in radiotherapy treatment planning, because this is a CT scanner which is in the radiotherapy department used exclusively for treatment planning. Next one. Use of computerised planning systems and being able to plan things in three dimensions rather than just two dimensions has improved really our ability to give a more homogeneous dose or even dose throughout the breast, and that's particularly important in breast because the breast is quite a complex three-dimensional volume, and so having that ability to plan in three dimensions has certainly made a difference. Some of the other technical advantages I've put on here, and that's our ability to put in some extra heart shielding because we know where the heart is on those planning images. We can use what's called a field-in-field technique, or some people call it poor man's IMRT, which you can do on any planning system to even out the dose. And potentially some of these respiratory gating, which really means giving the radiotherapy at a particular phase of the respiration cycle, might help reduce the degree of lung and heart in the path of the treatment as well. And next one. And so I'm just going to digress from that because it really it brings us close to, I was going to say, what everyone calls the sexy new area in radiotherapy, which is IMRT, image modulated radiation therapy, which you might have heard about. It every so often gets heralded as being a great breakthrough in radiation treatment in the press. And this, I guess, is really using all those imaging and planning technology advantages together with the modern LIRI accelerators fitted with the multi-lead collimator to vary it, varies the size and the shape of the treatment field actually during the treatment. And so this potentially results in giving a more homogeneous dose to the actual target volume and less dose to the surrounding tissues. And I guess that's roughly what Philotrope will do. This is actually a prostate plan where the red is the sort of high dose area and the green and blue are sort of areas they're getting very little dose. But you can see there are multiple radiotherapy beams coming in from all directions to achieve that plan. Now this has been particularly taken up it was very enthusiastically worked by the people who treat head and neck cancers and pelvic tumours, prostate cancer, bladder cancer, to some extent some of the gynecological cancers, but it really hasn't been used a great deal in breast cancer treatment. And the big advantage of IMRT is potentially being able to increase the dose to the tumour without increasing the side effects, because you're not increasing the dose to the normal tissues. But it may be in breast treatment that the tumour control is already very good, and dose escalation really isn't something that we want to do, because all that's going to do is make a breast that's less like a normal breast. And the toxicity of normal treatment isn't particularly severe. The late toxicity is low on all of them. It's possible that chest movement which you have when you're treating the breast may negate the benefits you might get from IMRT. And that a lot of these technical advances we've already had really does as good as IMRT can do for the breast. But certainly in America, IMRT is used a lot for everything. But IMRT takes much longer to plan, to QA and to deliver to a patient than conventional type radiation treatments. And so unless you can demonstrate a benefit in terms of better tumour control or less toxicity, it really is hard to justify the extra resources for treating breast cancer.
Can we have the translation of IMRT?
Image modulated radiation therapy, so it's on the previous slide.
Is it more expensive?
Yeah. Vastly more expensive.
Oh.
one can plan a breast patient in probably about 3 hours, conventional treatment. With IMRT, it probably takes you a couple of days. And the treatment time is much longer. On the machine, the actual treatment time, because it's treating lots of different beams, whereas even if we're using field and field where you might have 4 beams, it still doesn't take very long. Whereas this can have 7, 8, 10 beams in IMRT. It's a different issue in prostate cancer, because there is quite definitely a benefit from giving a bigger dose for prostate. You can get the dose up higher, cure more prostate cancer. But if you do put the dose up higher with conventional treatment, you get a lot more rectal toxicity, a lot more late side effects with the rectum and the bladder. Whereas with IMRT, you can avoid those things, because you can keep the dose on those structures low but give a bigger dose to the prostate. And so it does have, it hasn't been proven yet, but it has the potential to improve the cure rate in prostate cancer. But that's not true with breast cancer. It's a different situation. So we're going to move on to really hypofractionation is reducing the number of treatments and the overall treatment time, but it also means reducing the total dose as well. And there have been a couple of trials which have looked at doing this in breast cancer, and particularly the Canadian trial. I mean, both have showed similar low rates of local recurrence post the experimental treatment, which is 15 or 16 treatments as opposed to 25. But the follow-up in these trials is still relatively short. I guess the patients that this was given to were people who have relatively low risk and some and generally an older population rather than a younger population. So whether this is generally applicable is still yet to be seen. But the trial results suggest the same tumour control and the same cosmetic outcome, because this smaller, what looks like smaller dose in numbers, is actually biologically an equivalent dose to the 25 treatments, okay, to the standard dose treatment. So you get the same side effects and the same tumour control, at least that's the theory. And so far, that looks relatively promising, but it's still only in Canada and the UK that they tend to use these more widely outside a clinical trial. We currently use these shorter treatment programs for treating older, less well people, people who aren't as fit or frailer, and the main advantage is that they don't get as tired from the treatment. I guess the last area where one can look at decreasing toxicity and also improving convenience is in partial breast irradiation. Now, traditionally it's been thought that you had to treat, it was necessary to treat the whole breast with radiotherapy really to get that low rate of local recurrence. And this was supported by a lot of pathology studies of mastectomy specimens that showed around, from immediately around the tumour, which is what you take out in a wide local excision, there were tumour cells in the adjacent breast tissue that went out to more than 2 centimetres away from that lesion, and sometimes even up to 5 centimetres away. So it was thought that the radiotherapy is really killing off these odd cells that were left behind after the local excision. But there's been quite a bit of attempts to try to identify groups of patients where the recurrences almost invariably occur at the tumour bedside rather than further away. And so in some studies they have been able to pick out somewhere 80 to 100% of recurrences occurring close to the tumour bed, but in other studies you only get about 56% of recurrences occurring close to that surgical tumour bed. And it depends, you know, it's the pathology features of the tumour that's removed and the lymph nodes that are helping these people select which patients might be in these, if they say, favourable breast tumours, really tumours where the recurrences are going to occur close to where the original tumour was. Because if you can identify those patients, you could irradiate just the tumour bed. And that's what partial breast radiotherapy is all about. Excellent. But you don't want to get, blinded by boys and new toys, because there are a number of different techniques for doing partial breast irradiation. And you see in the press and in the medical literature, even people getting excited about a particular technique as being a new breakthrough. But in fact, they're all variations of partial breast irradiation. And partial breast irradiation is not yet a proven curative treatment for breast cancer. So I think you've got to remember that, number one. Anyway, I'm just going to go through some of the techniques that are available. This multi-catheter interstitial brachytherapy is basically the oldest method, and certainly in Europe has been used as a form of wave-giving partial breast irradiation for quite a long period of time. Next one. I think I've got a picture. It's the same as this picture I showed you before. Next one. In some centres it gives excellent local tumour control and minimal side effects, but in other centres you see quite high rates of local recurrence and lots of complications. And it very much relates to how accurately those sources are inserted in the breast and their spacing and the geometry of them, it's called, to the arrangement of the implant of that in the breast. There are a number of intraoperative techniques, and this is treatment that's given at the time of the surgery. The first one is the mammocyte balloon, which they use a lot in America, and you see occasionally mentioned in our media as being a great new breakthrough. Basically what it is after the operation they put a catheter with a balloon in it in the cavity where the tumour was taken from, and then they fill up the balloon with radioactive fluid or fluid containing a radioactive isotope, and that will irradiate just the tumour cavity. And it's usually placed at operation, it's usually filled up post-operatively, and then after the time to deliver the dose that's wanted, it's drained out and you can just pull the catheter out and everything heals up, and that's the total treatment for that patient. The intrabeam device, intrabeam devices, we have one of these machines in Melbourne, they have one in Perth as well. This is really a low energy X-ray source, which is really down here at the end, in the end of this ball. And basically what's happening, this is the operation cavity, you can see this is where the tumour's been removed and this is where the axillary nodes have been looked at. And what happens is that this gets placed in the operation cavity at the when they're finished, the rest of the surgery, and the skin is closed up really over the sphere, and then the machine is turned on. Usually it's about 20 minutes to deliver one single dose of radiation to that tumour bed area, and then it's taken out and the wound's sewn up, and that's the patient goes back to the ward. And that's the total treatment for that person. Now these treatments are all single dose, and they're by necessity a big dose of radiation to that tumour bed. And I suppose you may have recently read or heard in the paper, they made a big trumpet about the Target trial, which was a trial using this intrabeam machine, and they had the people from Perth saying how wonderful this treatment was. In fact, the follow-up in the trial is very early, and it's very difficult to know whether we have to wait and see whether these results are actually going to be translated into long-term local control. So far, they say they have very few recurrences, either in the standard treatment arm or in the intracyte arm, and they have no difference in toxicity. That's not quite our experience here. We don't think the cosmetic outcome from this treatment is as good as it is. Nevertheless, if you're a lady, if you live in WA and it takes you 2 days to get to Perth to have your treatment, the attraction of having all your treatment at the time you're in the hospital having your surgery is very attractive. The Italians, there's one centre in Italy that has a linear accelerator in the operating theatre, so they give a dose using an electron beam to the tumour bed at the time of surgery. No one else in the world has got that. And we have yet to see any results from that centre, although they've been using it for a long time. So it's unlikely that anyone else could afford to have a linear accelerator in their operating theatre for that sort of treatment. The last way of doing this is a partial breast irradiation. It's really external beam conformal radiotherapy, which is using an ordinary, normal linear accelerator. And really basically defining the area that we treat, which is the area where the operation is, having a little margin, and planning to just treat that region of the breast. Next one. And to do that, you get the target, and then you aim the treatment from any direction you like. Well, not exactly any direction you like, but avoiding these structures in here, to treat the target volume. And gives you really a dose distribution which covers the target volume, covers a good bit of the rest of the breast as well, although the aim is to have less than 25% of the whole breast actually in the high dose volume. And this treatment is then delivered as 2 or 3 fractions a day over 1 to 2 weeks. Different centres are doing it slightly differently. And so it adds a lot of inconvenience for the patient because it's a short, concentrated treatment. Means you might have to be at the radiotherapy centre all day, but you only have to do that for 2 weeks as opposed to come every day for 5 or 6 weeks. There are a lot of ongoing studies of this in various places around the world, not just here. The advantages of this sort of treatment is, though, it could be done in any radiotherapy centre. although it's obvious that very accurate localisation of the tumour bed is required to make sure that you're actually giving the high-dose region to the right part of the breast, there's less margin for error, and you're going to need good immobilisation of the patient. But the disadvantage of this compared to the operative techniques is that you're irradiating quite a lot of the breast and you're irradiating potentially other parts of the body with these different beams directed externally, whereas the intraoperative techniques treat the breast and a little bit of the tumour cavity and a little bit around it and virtually nothing else. But I can say all partial breast radiation treatments are experimental treatments, and despite the fact that in America they're widely used outside clinical trials, they shouldn't be performed outside a clinical trial because the effectiveness of these treatments has yet to be proven. And I think that's what's often forgotten when these things get a lot of trumpeting in the press. They are in the process of being evaluated, but we don't know whether that's going to be as good a treatment as the treatment we already know about.
Okay, so we'll move on.
Because I just wanted to talk a little bit about palliative treatment, because that's really a major area of radiotherapy. Next one, please. Because any cancer really can spread from the place it begins to other sites in the body. And probably all know this, but the site at which the tumour begins is really the primary tumour site. And these deposits of the cancer that are in other places away from the primary site are either called secondary cancers or metastatic cancers. Now the thing about the secondary cancer though is that it looks like the primary cancer when you look at it under the microscope. And it behaves like the primary cancer in terms of its growth pattern, its growth rate, and most importantly, its response to treatment. Now in theory, secondary cancer deposits can occur in any part of the body, but some cancers, or most cancers, really have particular patterns of spread, so where it spreads more commonly to some parts of the body than others. And I guess breast cancer, certainly bones and the lungs and the liver are the more common places for that to spread. And secondary cancers will produce a symptom or symptoms, depending a bit on where they are in the body. The symptoms will depend on where they are, but they will always produce some symptoms before they become particularly large. Because this is really just a definition of palliative treatment in general, and that it's really treatment aimed at relieving symptoms and relieving pain, improving the level of function, and thereby improving quality of life. So palliative radiotherapy really is treatment aimed at relief of symptoms and therefore improved quality of life. And I guess radiotherapy has always had a major role in palliative treatment, palliative cancer treatment. Really because radiotherapy is a very effective cancer cell killing agent, and it will kill off the cells in a secondary deposit so that the tumour will shrink, the source of the symptoms will be relieved and disappear, and that's how the symptoms are relieved, if you like, because the cancer in that deposit is killed. It doesn't kill every cancer deposit in the body, but it kills the ones that you actually treat. And so I think in palliative treatment you also have to consider that improvement in quality of life isn't going to occur if the treatment itself has a lot of side effects. And one also needs to consider that the patients with metastatic cancer have a shorter lifespan, and one can't really, or one shouldn't, consume the rest of their remaining life with going through treatment. So the major benefits, I guess, of radiotherapy in palliative treatment is the speed with which symptom improvement occurs and the certainty of response. And you've got to give sufficient radiation dose to ensure that the disease responds, and you do get relief of symptoms. And you need to give enough to make sure that the symptom relief lasts for as long as the person lives. So that the principles of palliative radiotherapy are really, it's very important to have an accurate anatomical localization of the symptomatic tumour deposit. You've got to know where the symptoms are coming from, so that you can treat that particular tumour deposit. We usually use fairly simple treatment techniques, short treatment programs, moderate dose treatment, so that you get a good predictable response, but it also minimises treatment toxicity, and you don't want to be using 5 and 6 week treatment programs in someone whose life expectancy might only be 3 months. Not the best way of treating somebody.
Next one.
And so these are really some of the main areas of palliative treatment.
Next one.
And I guess this, and I'll show you some of these. This is really what a bone metastasis looks like. This is CT down through a vertebral deposit. But you can see really that the bone here is being eroded, and there's a soft tissue here as opposed to bone. And this soft tissue you're looking at is the cancer. When you see that on a plain X-ray, which is what this is, all you see really is the missing bone. You actually don't see the soft tissue. And that's why often people talk about holes in the bone, because that's what it looks like on a diagnostic X-ray. But they're not holes, there's something there. There's a tumour there, so that's not just a gap. Next one. Anyway, I like showing these pictures, because this is an X-ray of the pelvis, but there's a bigish metastatic deposit here eroding the bone. You can see the outline of the shape of the pelvis is a bit missing here, as you can see on the other side.
Next one.
And the radiotherapy field really covered all that bone. Next one. And if you get rid of the tumour, the normal body's bone healing processes will actually heal up the bone, and you can see this bone's healing. You don't always see that, that's why I like showing it, because it's a nice, impressive series of pictures. But you don't always see the bone heal up, but you don't have to see that to have relief of the symptoms. You get bone, the response in terms of improvement in pain occurs very rapidly. Bone healing probably takes 6 months, 9 months to occur. Pain relief from bone metastases takes about up to 2 weeks, 2-3 weeks to occur post radiotherapy. So the pain relief occurs much earlier, much sooner than bone healing occurs.
Excellent.
And brain metastases, and that has become another major area we use radiotherapy, because brain metastases are not all that common, I guess, in terms of metastatic disease. But they're usually multiple, they're usually not amenable to surgical resection, and they cause pressure in the brain, which gives headache, and they may press on the various nerve structures in the brain and interfere with function. And this is the CT scan, really, which shows you what brain metastases look like on the scan. But these big black areas are in fact swelling in the brain, what it looks like on a scan. But if you treat the brain with radiotherapy, it'll shrink those tumour deposits, and it gets rid of the cause of the swelling, so the swelling goes away. And so it relieves symptoms, it also relieves pressure on the nerve structure so that you can get improvement in function if the nerves haven't been too severely damaged. And so it's usually a 1 or 2 week course of treatment. And there are various sites in the body where tumours might produce bleeding or ulceration or fungation, and I guess this can occur in many types of cancers, but you can dry up bleeding and you can get rid of sort of messy, discharging, ulcerating tumours with radiotherapy very effectively. Next one. But I was going to say radiotherapy has to be integrated into the total management plan for someone with metastatic cancer. Certainly in breast cancer, most people might have some local radiotherapy for particular symptoms or particular symptomatic lesions, but then either have hormone therapy or chemotherapy to really be a systemic treatment to treat the rest of their metastatic disease. And I guess really I just put that in because I think want to emphasise the fact that a multidisciplinary team is the best way to treat people with metastatic cancers or advanced cancers as it is with people for curative cancers or early cancers. Thank you. Questions?
Does the radiation, you know, you have like a bone scan and, you know, your mammograms and all those things, does it add up? Does it stay in your body, you know? Because no one tells you that.
Yeah,
and you sort of think, well, am I going to be, you know...
Well, if you're having... If you're having treatment with external beam of radiation, when the machine's off, there's no more radiation, it's off. If you're in the same, if you're having a CT scan taken or a plain X-ray taken, when they turn the machine off, radiation's gone, nothing more. When you have something like a bone scan, they're actually giving you a dose of a radioactive isotope into the bloodstream, and it goes around in the bloodstream, and what they're picking up is the radioactive decay of that. And that's why they often tell you to stay away from babies and things in that first 24 hours after the scan, and it is because you are radioactive, if you like, to a very low level, but nevertheless. And it decays away in a very short period of time. So in 24 hours, it's gone. You can't detect it anymore. If you put a brachytherapy implant into someone, that's using a radioactive isotope, and for as long as the sources are there, there will be radioactivity. The ones I showed you are all temporary implants, so they get taken out. When the person leaves hospital, they don't have any radioactivity. They do treat some prostate cancers by putting in permanent implants, which are putting seeds into the prostate. But whenever that's done, the patient is given instructions about what care they need to take, not so much for them, but for the people around them. And it's worked out when enough decay has occurred for those doses to be low enough or not to be any concerns to anybody else. The main reason I focus on children, or infants and children usually, is because the aim is to try and give them no dose, if you like, until they're adults, basically. It's a radio protection type rule. But with a bone scan, say, the whole body dose is extremely small. It's a measurable dose, but it's different because you can't add them up because it's a whole body dose as opposed to if you compare it with a CT scan. The dose of the CT scan will seem a lot higher, but it's only to the portion of the body where the pictures are being taken. And all those diagnostic doses are sort of a mile from therapy doses. And so you must, I guess one of the basic tenets in diagnostic radiology is that you must have a good reason for doing a test. And by the good reason it means you're finding out something important that you can't find out any other way. If you can find it out some other way, well then you use the other method of finding it out if it doesn't involve radiation. And I think there's been, you know, you probably also, the press has been going wild on, you know, too many CT scans, etc. You can't make that sort of judgment, every test has to be what they sort of call justified, and so there has to be the doctor ordering the test has to have a good medical reason for doing the test, so that you can't just rock up to your GP and say, oh, I'm feeling a bit off today, I'll have a CT, whole body CT, thanks. Well, he should say not.
Yeah.
And the radiologist that you go to with your bit of paper saying, I'm having it because I feel a bit crook, should just say no. There has to be a good question to answer to justify what is a small radiation exposure in the overall scheme of things, but it's still a radiation exposure. And that's what all the fuss was about in the major source of radiation exposure to our population in general, I don't know in this country, but in the US, is certainly medical radiation. Mm-hmm. And it is because there are lots of people having tests. The assumption is that there are lots of people having tests that are maybe not justified. And so, isn't it reason to be frightened about the radiation, it's just actually to be very clear that you've got a question to answer when you're doing it.
Should I be concerned about the cardiac reaction after radiotherapy in what, 10 years?
I can't answer that because you should ask whoever treated you. I mean, I'm assuming you had radiation treatment.
Yes.
You should ask whoever treated you because it relates very much to the radiation, where you've had the radiation, and to some extent what dose it was, but it's more where it was and what it was given for.
I was told there could be a mark on a lung x-ray, so I'd have it later on. But I
didn't
know about the cardiac until you mentioned it.
Well, even before 1980, the level of risk is very small. I mean, for me, because it's a level of risk that really in the past nobody would have worried about. And we go to great lengths now to get rid of this risk, but it's minor. If you've got that depression, you need to ask who treated you. But overall, in breast cancer terms, you know, they have to look at thousands and thousands of patients to pick up this very tiny difference. Some people do, usually after the first dose of treatment, some people might get an excessive, well, it depends on the, you know, really I was thinking in bone terms, some people do get a bit of an increase in the degree of pain they have, which usually then settles down over the next few days. It's thought that relates perhaps to some swelling that occurs around the tumour from the radiation, effect of the radiation on the tumour with the first treatment. So it's usually with the first treatment that you get that. But you don't always get that. It's not very common. If you're treating things in the brain, you almost always get some swelling effect in the brain. If people have already got swelling and then you increase it, their headache will be worse and their symptoms will be worse. But you counteract that by giving them dexamethasone prior to the treatment, and that usually stops that occurring. You don't usually give people steroids for the bones because you're not really risking, yes, it's more painful, but you're not actually risking greater pressure on nerves and maybe a deterioration in their nerve functions, is what happens in the head. But in my experience, it's not that common in bones, but it happens.
I just wanted to ask, talking about the benefits of radiotherapy, and it was a good percentage, but when it came to survival, it was 1%.
Yeah.
What's the story in between?
Oh, well, it's really because it's really to do with just the nature of breast cancer itself. Breast cancer is not just, well, that's not just one disease, it's one disease, but there are a lot of different behaviour patterns of different breast cancers. And there's no doubt some breast cancers really have spread from almost the time they existed in the breast. And that kind of, you know, spread to other places in the body has occurred before anyone ever knows there's a tumour in the breast. No, because the scans won't pick up microscopic disease. And we know from the fact that right people get metastatic disease when they've got no local recurrence. It's disease is cured locally, but they turn up later with medicine, you know, with a breast cancer deposit somewhere else. And so no amount of extra local treatment can cure those people, no matter what you do. And I think that was well shown during the 40s, 50s and 60s. But not all breast cancers are like that. The way you treat or tackle patients breast cancers that are like that is by giving a systemic treatment up at the beginning. And that's what adjuvant chemotherapy and hormotherapy is about. And we know that if you do that, you cure a certain percentage of those patients. Don't cure them all, but you cure a fair number. But there are other people, other breast cancers that don't spread that early. And it might grow for quite a while in the breast before they decide they're going to spread. And if you've treated those breast cancers locally before that spread occurs, well, then you've cured the patient with the local treatment. But with local recurrence, I guess what we worry about is in some patients, well, we know historically that in some patients when local recurrence occurs, it's really just a signal that they've got disease that's going to recur. Because when they've got their local recurrence, they've got metastatic disease as well. And we think that's cancer that was just, if you like, bad biologically because it spread early and it was fairly resistant to treatment locally because it's come back despite the local treatment. There will be some cancers that recur because the local treatment was inadequate in some way. But once it's back there, once it's there and growing in the breast, there is the potential for that local recurrence to spread somewhere else. And so if you actually can treat them so that the local recurrence doesn't occur, you stop that spread from the local recurrence to produce a metastasis. Okay. And so they're the people that you can improve the survival rate. But that's only a percentage of the total breast cancer population. So that's why you only see a little difference from doing that. And you've got to have it makes a big difference in local recurrence rates, but it only makes a small difference in survival because there's only a percentage of those people who have local recurrence who wouldn't have had metastatic disease if they hadn't had local recurrence.
Yeah. I was interested in you talking about damage maybe to the heart. What about the lungs?
Yeah. Well, I think you saw in those pictures, there is a little bit of lung in the path of the treatment, with standard breast irradiation anyway, because there's no way you can avoid that and treat the whole breast. And of course the breast wraps around the rib cage. But the amount of lung in the path of treatment is usually small. And the toxicity I showed you was in fact the toxicity for that sort of lung volume. It's really less than 1%. There's always a scar there. There's always a bit of lung that's scarred. Usually it's too small to see on the chest x-ray, but you can see it on the CT scan because they're pretty sensitive. But it's rare for them to give you any symptoms in breast cancer radiotherapy. It's a different matter in other tumours. In lung cancer treatment, there certainly is. You're treating a lot more lung most of the time, and so the risk of getting side effects from the treatment is a bit higher, but it's still low.
You mentioned that for younger women, radiation radiotherapy lasts specifically as compared to 5. What's the rationale for that?
Well, there's evidence that in younger women, they get better local control if you give them that extra week of treatment. But it's not an extra week of treatment to the whole breast. It's what's often referred to as a boost to the tumour bed, and that's treating the tumour bed area. And I suppose historically we did that for everybody, but 10 years or so ago, the Europeans did a trial, which they called the Boost-No Boost study, where they randomised people to one or the other. And they found that certainly for women under 50, there was an extra improvement, another 2-3% improvement in local control by giving them a boost. And the older you got, the less that was evident. They've extended it now up to 60. But beyond 60, there's minimal benefit from the extra week treatment. So basically, we let people off that extra week treatment. Really means they get all the benefit from 5 weeks. Whereas if you're younger than that, and the younger you are, the more important that boost seems to be, and the bigger the benefit it gives you. So that's why certainly the younger women you always give them a boost to the tumour bed, because it gives them the lowest chance of recurrence.
But just one about the delayed effects. Why the progressive effects later on?
Yeah, well, I guess late effects are somewhat harder to explain because they relate to the radiation effects on some of the. It's a different process underlying late effects, probably. They evolve over a long period of time. But the tolerance doses really are talking about the effects over that long period of time, if you like. They're not sort of saying, okay, well, this is what you see at 3 years, but you know, by 5 years it'll be worse, and 10 years it'll be worse. It isn't like that. The late effects give you a good assessment of really the level of sort of significant change you might see in the tissues at 20 odd years or something. And well, when they say progressive, it is, but very slow. And so late effects are things that are very sensitive to the fraction size in the treatment. That's why people are very reluctant to consider a bigger fraction size in treatment, because we know over time that if you give a short course of treatment with big fractions, a small number of big fractions, it's a recipe for giving you more severe late effects. And that's why the single treatment a day over 5 weeks, 6 weeks, sometimes 7 weeks is used most often, because we know that is the lowest level of late effects possible. It's very relevant when you're talking about curative treatment with radiotherapy, because you expect the person's going to live a long time. In palliative treatment, it's not so important, because the person, some people do live a long time with metastatic disease, but you have to make a judgment about how likely that is before you start using sort of some of these short treatment programs. But the thing that saves you in palliative treatment is you're not giving as big a dose as you are in curative treatment. You're giving a lesser dose, so you've got a bit more margin for error, if you like, or margin for improvement.
My question goes back to the original tumour. What about, you mentioned size, what about shape?
Shape doesn't matter. They're not just round balls like marbles, most of them. They're in any shape possible, but it's not the shape that's important, it's the size.
And whether they're lobular or the other one, does that matter?
No. Lobular and ductal distinction doesn't have an impact on prognosis, and it doesn't have an impact on response to treatment. And so they're all treated the same way, but there are some differences in impacts. Patterns of spread and ease of diagnosis and stuff between lobular and ductal cancer, but in terms of how they behave and what the prognosis is, it's no different.
Question about reconstruction.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, just post-mastectomy and radiation.
Yeah. Oh, you can have reconstruction post-mastectomy radiotherapy, although it's usually done with your own tissue. The skin's not terribly stretching post radiotherapy, and if they put it under too much tension, it can all break down.
Yeah.
So it's usually muscle flap or some combination of that. It's an issue to discuss with plastic surgeons.
Yeah.
They're
yeah.
pretty good at, I mean, they're well aware of the radiation type issue.
So, Ros, on behalf of everybody here, thank you for sharing your insights and expertise, and it's very generous of Ros to give up her time to come down here today and talk to us. So, thank you very much, Ros.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. You can subscribe to Brecan Podcasts or browse existing podcasts by visiting www.brecan.org.au.